Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to the Frogs of War podcast. I am Jamie. She is Melissa.
Hello.
Melissa, I've got a complaint right off the bat here.
Coming in hard. All right.
It has to do with the volume toggle on Blog Talk Radio for the intro
Not
music.
Not ideal.
It has like 8 settings, and they are extremely loud. Or extremely quiet, and there's really no in between.
So is what you're telling me here that Blog Talk Radio volume settings are to accessibility as Big 12 expansion numbers are to math ability? That's kind of where I feel like you're going with this.
This is exactly right, because just like Blog Talk Radio struggles with volume levels, the Big 12 struggles with basic counting.
And apparently they're on that new math.
They're on that new math, that Common Core. But for those of you that don't know what we're talking about, the Big 12 apparently narrowed down their list of candidate schools today, potential schools for expansion, to 6 or 8. Jim Benneman of CBS4 in Colorado tweeted earlier this afternoon, breaking, CBS4 has learned that Colorado State has made the first cut. As the Big 12 Conference mulls expansion, 18 interested schools now whittled to 6 to 8. So Melissa, that sounds normal. Colorado State is a name that we've been throwing around quite a bit. I think it's a pretty good cut to cut 10 to 12 teams right off the bat and really kind of focus in on some quality possibilities. But then we also have Matt Brown, one of the college managers for SB Nation, tweet out about 20 minutes after Jim Benneman tweets the quote, 6 to 8 teams that made the first Big 12 cut reportedly include, now keep count here, okay?
Cut.
Cincinnati.
Ding.
BYU.
Ding.
UConn.
Ding.
Memphis.
I did not make the cut, ding.
You didn't make the cut. I'm sorry.
That's sad.
South Florida.
Ding.
Central Florida.
Ding.
Temple.
Ding.
Colorado State.
Ding.
SMU.
Ew. Ding.
Yeah. And Houston.
Ding. Okay.
How many
now,
is that?
Jamie,
that's
I have
10.
To be real forthright here. I'm not great at math. I was
okay. Let me tell
radio,
you.
TV, film major at TCU. I did not do well in my basic math course, just to lay it out there. That does not add up to 8. I'm fairly certain. I don't want to put money on it, but I'm pretty confident that's double digits. And double digits automatically means it's not 6 to 8.
That is correct. That was actually 10 schools that Matt listed there. So those are the 6 to 8 teams that are remaining, or those 10. There's also a rumor out there that there are actually 12 schools still in the mix. And some of those schools are applying to be full members, and others are hoping to be football-only members. And some are kind of waffling back and forth, saying we would just like to be associated with the Big 12 in any way possible. If that means we're full members, great. If that means we're football-only, great. So it just feels like the Big 12 cannot get out of its own way when it comes to expansion. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Well, it's frustrating, and it's frustrating as one of the quote-unquote new members of the conference that after our long walk in the wilderness, like so many Moseses, we finally thought we had found the promised land, only to see a couple years later it go up in a – or potentially go up in a cloud of dust oh so quickly and horrendously. First of all, the Big 12 likes to pride itself as an academic, full of nice, solid academic institutions. the first thing you need to do is to start getting your basic math skills down, because it does not mean 10 to 12, just like the Big 12 does not mean 10 teams. That
this
in and of itself has kind of made it a little bit of a laughing stock on a national scale, I feel, but you can't really say too much because the Pac-12, which is full of really wonderful academic institutions, is I think like 27 teams or something. So I guess it's not just a Big 12 problem. But, you know, the second thing is control your leaks. You know, like I totally understand. Yeah. I had to have done journalism. I get that. Leaking is a refined art form in the media, especially with social media. But if you're going to leak information that's sensical. They've done themselves no favors here. I like the idea of listing these teams out, of kind of putting it out there. Hey, we're moving. We've got some progress right before the season. Turn the onus back onto the Big 12 for a couple of days. But if you're going to put something out there, at least put something out there that has some rhyme or reason to it and is actually going to make people go, oh, they're getting their crap together, as opposed to, oh, they're still the Big 12. That's what's frustrating to me as a fan.
Yeah, the Big 12 has become synonymous at this point with just kind of being that group of bum-fuzzled old men that really don't know what direction is the best direction, so they choose just to talk for hours on end with no real results.
They are like a man trying to find his way without asking for a map. Sorry, no offense.
They're like the guys that just sit on the front porch and talk and shout at children as they walk by.
Yep, get off my lawn unless you can potentially save our conference.
Well, actually, no, SMU, you can stay on the lawn for a little bit, apparently. Melissa, though, your favorite, your dream team, your number one pick to get in, did not make the cut. East Carolina is not on this list.
I am legitimately sad about that. I really liked ECU as a Big 12 candidate. The fact that they would leave SMU on the list and not leave ECU to me is just laughable. The Ponies have no shot. I'm sorry, SMU fans. I totally love that you are trying to pour some money into your stadium and that you're going to turn that little bandbox that doesn't even, frankly, at this point live up to the high school stadiums in the area into something resembling a collegiate football town. But SMU is not a candidate for the Big 12. They can't be. And it really is too bad. I'd love to see the Ponies get up to speed and so that we don't have to keep having these conversations about dropping them from our schedule. Temple, Philly's a great market. Philly Frog, if you're listening, I know you'd love this. But again, that's not a viable candidate, to my opinion, over a school like ECU. But, you know, when there's no rhyme or reason to how they make these decisions, there's really no sense questioning what they're thinking, because I don't even think that they know.
You're right. I don't think that they know, because if they knew, this would have been a process that would have been completed at this point. I mean, we've known who the front runners are for almost a year now. So if they had any sense of direction, this would have been an accomplished feat already. There would already be 12 teams. They would be playing in the 2016 season with 12 teams. They would have gone to two divisions already. But the fact that they haven't just shows that, yeah, you're right. There's no direction. There's no sense of what is right at this point. And it also kind of signals that they're so gridlocked as a conference. They can't get on the same page to even narrow it down any further than, you know, 6 to 8 to 10.
All right. Well, let's play a game.
Okay.
Let's play the game that you and I are running the Big 12 conference. Okay. This is a game where the Big 12 conference has a shot of actually surviving here for another 10 years.
I like this game.
All right. So I want you to do two things, okay? We'll do this real Big 12 style. We'll talk out of both sides of our rear here. Give me your top four candidates that you'd like to see out of the 6 to 8 that's actually 10 teams, and then give me your top four candidates that you think are the most likely to actually make the cut.
Okay. Top four and then realistic four.
Yes.
Okay. Top four would be Cincinnati, BYU, Houston, and UConn.
Okay.
Now, the four that I think will actually make the cut, Cincinnati, BYU, Houston, and maybe UConn, maybe Colorado State.
I was really hoping you'd go Big 12 style and list off all, you know, 10 teams, but I think it's a pretty good list.
Well, hey, there are actually 11. I left Air Force off that list. Air Force made
Air
the
Force.
Cut. Carolina did not make the
goodness.
Cut. Tulane did not make the cut, but Air Force made the cut.
Well, there you have it. True Big 12 style.
So what about you? So what about you? Your top four versus realistic four.
My top four out of this list, I think, would probably be Cincinnati,
okay.
BYU, Colorado State, and I'm going to say Memphis over UConn. I'm going to say Memphis over UConn. Yeah. My realistic four. Go ahead.
Well, what's your reasoning then for Memphis over UConn?
Am I going to sound like the girl that shouldn't talk sports if I say Justin Timberlake?
No.
I'm kidding.
No, you're not.
You know what I think it comes down to is I think that Memphis has, with FedEx's backing, if they're legitimately as serious as they say they are, the money that they're going to bring to the conference, the money that they'll pour into that university. Plus, you know, I love the idea of adding a really solid basketball program as well. Not that adding UConn doesn't add a really solid basketball program, obviously. Maybe I don't want to, we talked about the women's team. Maybe I don't want to see them, twice a year. That could be part of it. But I think from a location, the geography of it, I like the footprint of the Big 12 that includes Memphis. I like the travel possibilities, with Memphis. I think that's a city that has been slowly but surely on the rise the last decade probably, and is really on the precipice of being able to support that football program and that team in a way that could make them a viable member going forward. I hope it's not that they just were good under Justin Fuente. I hope that was the start of a nice growth pattern for the Tigers, which obviously would be the difference maker in whether they got the invite or not. But I do think that their football program has a brighter future than UConn's right now. And maybe that market isn't as good as the Bristol market, or the what city is UConn in? I'm blanking on that right now.
It's a small state, so.
Yeah, it's all the same. You know, if you can bring in ESPN, you can bring in UConn, Connecticut as a whole. You know, that's a nice area, the New York market, et cetera. But I think Memphis just makes a little bit more sense, which means that they won't make.
It's just ridiculous. At this point, might as well kind of put expansion talk on the back burner, though, because Melissa, I don't know if you know this, but it's game week.
Game week.
It is game week. TCU football plays in like 60-something hours, 70-something hours.
Big 12 math.
Big 12 math.
They're going to be president of the conference.
At 7 p.m. against South Dakota State, the Jackrabbits. How do you feel? First thoughts. Thoughts about TCU playing a game on Saturday, and then first thoughts about South Dakota State.
My first thoughts automatically are, thank goodness college football is back. It's been a rough summer in the world. It has been a rough summer in this country, and I don't think anything quite galvanizes the people in love or appropriate hatred like college football does. So I can't wait to see the Frogs take the field, the new look Frogs take the field, to see what this team is. We've talked about potential all summer. You know, we've seen what all the pundits have to say and who people think this team can be versus who they think they will be. So I'm ready just to get them on the field, to watch them run out of that tunnel, to hear that frog horn, and just to see what this team is going to be all about. And what I'm really, really excited for after last season is to see a Gary Patterson defense that looks a lot like a Gary Patterson defense. That gets back hopefully to that ball hawking, turnover making machine that we've been blessed with the last 2 years here in Fort Worth, sans a year ago. South Dakota State is a tricky opponent. You know, I think that most TCU fans in a moment of honesty would say, yeah, we should handle business here, but it won't surprise me if it's close, especially in the first half. But, you know, after watching Teddy Bridgewater go down yesterday, a non-contact injury, I'm really hoping that they come out kind of guns blazing like we did against Minnesota in 2014 and really take care of business early so we can see some of the second, third string guys take snaps in a meaningful football game in the second half and get those starters off the field.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. You know, South Dakota State, I put it in the stats guide that I put out today, is one of those teams that if they're on your team schedule, you just kind of look at them and you groan a little bit. You've grown, first of all, because you see an FCS school on your schedule. And I don't think that there are any fans on the planet that actually really, truly like seeing an FCS school on their schedule if they're a Power 5 team. It's just kind of a very lackluster way to begin a season.
Sure.
Versus, you know, like Texas is hosting Notre Dame or Alabama
and
USC. Houston and Oklahoma, Florida State, Ole Miss. Like, you've got all of these premier matchups, and then you've got, like, Baylor playing Northwestern State. TCU is playing South Dakota State. Kansas is playing Rhode Island. I mean,
hey.
Well,
for Kansas, could be lined up
right.
a high school team, and I'd be excited
you're
for
right.
them to have a chance to win.
Well, yeah, because you know who they lost to in their opening game last season?
South Dakota State.
That's exactly right. So, but the Jackrabbits, they also make you groan as a person that sees them on your team schedule, because they're like a good enough FCS team to where they could possibly pull off some like miraculous Appalachian State level upset. They did it. I mean, they beat Kansas last year at Kansas, which, yes, it's Kansas, but it's still a Power 5 team. It's still an FBS team. Hosting an FCS team, it shouldn't happen. Losses like that shouldn't happen, even if you're Kansas. But South Dakota State came to play, and they came away with the win, 41-38 last year. They're going to come to play again this year, despite what their Twitter account is doing, already talking about their next opponent after TCU. I think it's Drake. So I don't know if that was just like a shout out to the VMAs or if they really were, you know, quote unquote, overlooking TCU. But South Dakota State's going to come to play, and they're going to come to play with some really, stout experience and good quality players, even for the FCS level. They're returning 15 starters, and that includes two quarterbacks that made significant starts last year, Zach Lugin and Taron Christian, both of whom started at least 8 games. And, you know, from the quarterback position, those two guys combined for about 3,500 yards of total offense. Through the air and on the ground. They combined for 26 total touchdowns. So they did have a little bit of ability back there. But they also return a wide receiver who, you know, TCU's got, I think the expectation, Melissa, is that TCU's secondary is going to be much better this year at the beginning of the season than it was in 2015 at the beginning of the season, or at least after, you know, Iloka and Tejada and a couple other guys went down with injuries. But they have this kid. His name is Jake Winicky, who had the second most receiving yards at the FCS level last year with 1,472. And that was on 72 receptions. The guy averaged 20 yards a catch, which is nuts. He had 11 receiving touchdowns. And against Kansas, he had 160 yards receiving and 2 touchdowns on just 8 catches. So this is a kid who can really stretch the field. And who can catch you off guard if you're not mentally prepared for playing a team like South Dakota State. South Dakota State is a good team. They were 8-4 last season. They made the FCS playoff before they lost to number 16 Montana in the first round. But South Dakota State, I mean, if you look at their schedule from 2015, Melissa, they played 6 games against ranked opponents at the FCS level, and they went 3-3 in those games. I mean, that includes a loss to North Dakota State, a loss to Montana in the playoffs, and a loss to, I believe it was Northern Iowa. But they beat Illinois State, who was the number 2 team at the FCS level. Their ranking got as high as 5 last year. And they've made the playoffs the last 4 years in a row at the FCS level. So this is not some sort of joke scrub of a team. This is not, Southeastern Louisiana State or whoever it was TCU played 2 years ago. It's not. Even Stephen F. Austin, who TCU played last year, this is a team that has the ability and the experience necessary to come into M&G and really give the frog fits if they're not mentally ready and prepared to play.
Well, I think there's a couple interesting points that you bring up as far as, we talk a lot about the mental readiness. There's no way that South Dakota State should be able to compete with TCU for 4 quarters, assuming the Frogs are focused and locked into play. And so I actually looked back over the last couple of years of the TCU schedule, and the last time that the Frogs opened the season with an FCS opponent was Grambling State back in 2012, which, if you remember, was the Deontay Gray first touch of his collegiate career, ran it back for a touchdown. TCU went on to win that game 56-0. Since then, they've opened up against LSU, Minnesota, and – that'd be our the 4 teams since then. So I think the one thing that we know about Gary Patterson is that he will have his team ready to play. It's very, very rare that we see them overestimate or underestimate an opponent to start the season, whether that's Minnesota.
Unless it's Kansas. I mean, they always, I feel.
But not the first game of the year. But not the first game of the year. So I think the Frogs have been known for strong starts. They've won three of the last four season openers, sans the LSU game, which I don't even bring that one up. But I think that if this were a game two after Arkansas, I'd be more concerned than I am that it's a season opener. This team has been told all summer long that they're not good enough, that they can't replace Josh Stockton, that they can't replace Trayvon Boykin, that they can't replace Aaron Green, that, you know, there's no way that they'll be ready for game one of the season with all these injured players coming back. They won't be in game shape. I can just imagine what the locker room talk is going to be like. And I think they will come out fired up to be playing at home in front of their home crowd. They're obviously 100% behind Kenny Hill. These players love this quarterback. And I think they would have been, you know, right behind Foster Sawyer too. But there's something about Hill and his personality that gets these guys fired up to play for him. And so I think that the difference is going to be the TCU defense will have more success with Dakota State offense, which I do think will score and be able to move the ball against them, than the South Dakota State defense will have against the TCU offense. It may just turn into one of those, we're just going to have to blow the doors off you and we're going to let you score, you know, 3, 4, 5 touchdowns, which might not look good in the final box score. But at the end of the day, I think the Frogs do just have far too many weapons for South Dakota State to hang around for all four quarters. Very interested to see, though, is Rantanee Tejada, who by all accounts is 100%, going up against this really, really exceptional wide receiver from South Dakota State and having a chance to kind of get thrown right to the fire and see if he can lock down that side of the field for the entire time that he's on the field, and to see if he really is back to being the guy that we thought he was primed to be a season ago.
Yeah, definitely. That's a matchup to watch. Another matchup to watch, I think, is going to be these how these front linebackers do. You know, you've Montrell Wilson and why don't I have a depth chart in front of me? Montrell Wilson and
Sammy Douglas,
his cohort,
Traven Howard.
Traven Howard, who is also starting this first game of the season. It's going to be really interesting to see how they handle this South Dakota State front and how they handle this running game, because it is really a dynamic running game. South Dakota State has a very mobile quarterback in Taron Christian and a really solid running back, two really solid running backs in Brady Mangarelli and Kyle Paris. Christian Mangarelli and Kyle Paris combined to run for about 1,300 yards last year. They were this kind of three-headed monster for South Dakota State. And that was really one of South Dakota State's kind of things that they leaned on last year, was their running game. And so it'll be interesting to see how these guys react. You know, they are undersized linebackers, but they played so well last season when they were kind of thrown into the fire with a year of spring under their belt and just getting a little bit heavier and getting a little bit stronger and just another year to learn the position. I'm going to be really interested to see how those two guys, Howard and Wilson, come out and play against this running game of South Dakota State.
Well, you know, one of the things we've heard from Patterson a lot this fall, too, is just the speed that he has on the edges with the edge rushers as well. You know, and if these are more mobile quarterbacks and with these running backs, I'm sure going to try to break it to the outside. Having guys like Tipagalea and Matt Boson and some of these guys that are a little bit more athletic and active on the outside, it'll be interesting to see how they're able to kind of lock down the edge and keep the quarterbacks in the pocket and force the running backs to go up the middle of the field, where I do think TC defense should be pretty strong.
Yeah, definitely. You know, defensive line is one of the, you know, you have a team like South Dakota State on your schedule, and then you think about the depth of TCU's defensive line, and you're hoping for maybe like an 8 or 9 sack game, because there is so much talent at the defensive line. I mean, the two guys that you just listed are backups, you know, and Josh Caraway was an all Big 12 player last year with 9 sacks. You've got James McFarland, who's coming back off a foot injury. And both of those guys are great edge rushers as well, and they're big and strong. And have a lot of games under their belt. So I do agree. I'm not trying to say in any stretch, like there's no way that South Dakota State, I think, actually wins this game. But my concern is that TCU does kind of fart around, for the first quarter, first, you know, 20, 25 minutes of the game, And the end result is that the box score doesn't look as clean as it probably should for a team like TCU in their first game of the season.
Well, do remember, this is the same South Dakota State team that gave up 38 points to Kansas last year. So
true. They also scored 41, though. They scored more points against Kansas than TCU did last year.
This is true. This is true. Maybe Kenny Hill will be the one to break the Kansas curse.
That would be nice. That would be really nice. Yeah, you know, Patterson's press conference was on Tuesday, his weekly press conference. He came out and immediately said he was glad that there were only 11 left, which I just think is a perfect kind of encapsulation of his personality. But he did, you know, talk a lot about San Diego State, just said that they returned 15 starters, that, you know, he was doing his best to get these guys mentally prepared, that they definitely weren't overlooking them for Arkansas. So at least, you know, the coach is saying all of the right things at this point in the season.
Yeah, well, and again, you know, I think that just comes down to Gary Patterson is not the one to think that his team is better than anybody, and we've heard it all fall, and I think I wrote an article about it last year for Frogs of War, that the angrier Gary Patterson is, the happier I am, because normally the more he's ripping his team apart, the higher his expectations are, because he knows just how good they can be. And I had a couple friends that had some conversations with him at Meet the Frogs, and he kind of had that wry smile of, we might be okay. Thinking that maybe, just maybe, that he's got something special on his hands, kind of the way that he felt going into the 2014 season. So it'll be interesting to sit back and watch. Like I said, I mean, for me, just getting out there, getting out to the tailgate, being in the stadium, hearing the Froghorn live again, that is all just as exciting as the thought of actually playing this game. But there's a lot we don't know about this TCU team. We're not going to get all the answers, obviously, after week one, but I think that we'll have a lot better idea of just the chemistry of this offense, if this defense is as good as we think they can be, the mentality that they're playing with, the aggression that they're playing with, because that's what really was missing last season to me. They were young, they were inexperienced, and they were thinking so much more than they were reacting. And that's why the turnovers were cut in half. We didn't have the interceptions. We didn't have the pass breakup that we're used to seeing. They should be a lot more conditioned to just go out there and react to the ball this year. And that should make things a lot more exciting on the defensive side of the field.
Oh, absolutely. A year can make all the difference. I mean, we saw that from 2013 to 2014. And like you said, Patterson, you know, I think he does have that confidence that a coach has when he knows he's got something special going on. You know, he was not hesitant to heap praise on a couple different positions at the press conference on Tuesday. He really, really is infatuated with what he's got going on at offensive line, Melissa. It's kind of crazy. When you think about the fact that TCU lost four offensive linemen off the starting line a year ago, and now he's coming in, and on Tuesday he said, you know, he's got eight or nine guys that are capable and ready to play, and there's only one senior offensive lineman on the entire roster. So what does that tell you? What does that tell you, I think, about, you know, about this season and then kind of moving forward? What does that tell you about the future of the offensive line?
Well, the really exciting thing about this TCU team in general is just while there are some snaps under their belt, it's a really, really young group. And that we could be looking, you know, at a potentially kind of a 2-year run where we don't see a whole lot of changes in the two deep. And that's something to look forward to for sure. That being said, this offensive line, you know, you're playing with a lot of guys that are going to have some time under their belts, but don't have a ton of starts, you know, to their names yet either. So to see how they gel, how they come together, but to also know that if they don't like the way they're playing, there's somebody that's maybe just a half notch behind them on the depth chart ready to take their spot. And I think the best teams are the ones where you have that healthy competition in practice, knowing that there's nobody just penciled in. You know, there's not a single guy on that line that probably feels good about, I'm going to be the 12-game starter no matter what. And I think they've shown in the past, too, that if they need to change things up, that's a position group that they're happy to do so. If they think it's going to benefit the team. Now with, you know, basically a new stable of running backs, you know, behind them, it's going to be super, super critical that the offensive line gels early and that they play to their strengths. But I do think that this is a group that has a ton of potential, but may have some issues early. You know, I don't want to look ahead too much, but that Arkansas game will be a really, really big test for a group that probably hasn't seen a power front quite like that as a unit before. So the depth is important. You know, I don't think there's a team in the country that knows how much depth can make a difference this season than TCU does after what happened last year. But until we see is that front five, that starting five, really good enough, or is it all just a bunch of guys that are not quite there to separate themselves to really say that these are our best five, and then we have a defined second group? Right now it sounds like we have a great eight, which could mean that we have eight really great players, or could mean that we don't have that group that's really identified themselves as being the elite level players from that position group.
Yeah, you're right. I tend to think, just based on, I mean, he was gushing. And so I tend to think that it's the former of those two. He thinks that Patrick Morris at left guard is just going to be a lockdown guard. And he thinks true freshman Lucas Niang is, just a phenomenal tackle and has all of the potential in the world. And so right now that means that true freshman is kind of the number three tackle on this team. And I don't think that youth necessarily means that you can't be elite. Sure. I mean, we've seen that a lot in recent years at the collegiate level, that these young kids can come in and really make a major impact on a squad right away. And I think that he's buying in to the talent that he has at offensive line.
Well, I will say Lucas Niang is definitely one of the guys that I was really excited about in February. He was a late flip coming over to TCU, kid out of Connecticut, so I'm sure he's Team UConn for Big 12 expansion. But not somebody that a lot of people knew about. You know what, though? I think he was a smart kid, though, too. So he, and offensive linemen tend to be the smartest guys on the field, from what I understand.
True.
Or at least
this
that's what they say. But I think that that he's a kid I was really excited about coming in on signing day, and that I thought had a potential to be, a four-year starter for TCU. I just assume, like most offensive linemen, he would probably redshirt, because that just seems to be what happened. The fact that Gary Patterson doesn't want to redshirt him this year and it has him on the depth chart does speak highly to not only his just sheer size, because he's a big dude, but if he's picked up the playbook that quickly in that offense, I feel pretty confident he might be something special, and I think we're going to see him on the field quite a bit this year.
The next in a long line of TCU offensive linemen can make it to
the next level. Can we give a shout-out to Joey Hunt in Seattle? Because it looks like he has all but locked up second-string center position for the Seahawks, along with Boykin all but locking up second-string quarterback. So the fact that they cut a guy who started like eight games last year to elevate Hunt. So Joey Hunt, if you're listening, super, super excited. That is an awesome, awesome
sir.
Move. Yes, props to you. And hey, we're really excited to have your brother be in the starting tight end here in Fort Worth this year too. Hunt
that
family's having a good
graduate
week.
Transfer. Yes, they are having a good week. They are indeed. So, one of these always, you tweeted about it earlier this week when it happened, I think, but there's always kind of some feel good stories that can come this time of year, especially when it comes to the football team. And that happened again yesterday when Patterson announced that Michael Downing, Matt Boggs, and Altman. What's Altman's first name?
Oh, you hadn't asked me. I would have known it.
Dang
it. Hold
on. Downing, Altman, and Boggs, all walk-on guys, were rewarded for their – thank you, Garrett Altman. They were all rewarded for their hard work, just grinding it out for quite a few years with scholarships. So they are on scholarship this year. It's an opportunity that I think is always best taken advantage of by coaching staffs to reward those guys who have just been the workhorses, the guys that have gotten such little recognition. Michael Downing did play a little bit last year, recovered that key fumble in the Oregon game that, it was one of those key plays that made that comeback possible. And now he's a scholarship player in 2016. So it's one of those feel good stories, these guys that have been working really hard and they get rewarded with scholarships for their final season.
I think it's such an important part of, the family atmosphere that Gary Patterson preaches about. There are a lot of times where you have to be the one to play the thankless role, whether it's being the walk-on player. Looking back, Kenny Hill playing for the scout team last year, a lot of these, not everybody gets to be the star. There are only 11 guys on the field at a time, which is so cliche, but it's true. But to fill out a roster of 100-plus players, you have to have those guys willing to come in and just do their jobs and fill their role. And this year you can look at Foster Sawyer, who by all accounts it appears is sticking around to back up Kenny Hill. I look at Grayson Muehlstein too, who came in with Foster Sawyer, mm-hmm. who again, and you know, these guys will make the decisions that's best for them, and you know, we'll support them, obviously, and always think of them as part of the family, even if they do choose to move on. But somebody, not everybody gets to start, not everybody gets to play, and the fact that these guys want to be a part of this program is just because of things like rewarding those three players with scholarships. It truly does seem to be more than lip service. The TCU football program is a family. And to see, you know, a guy, and Michael Downing's a name most of us are going to know. Matt Boggs, you know, is a long snapper, is a super important player too. But to see a guy like Downing, who, you know, I said something like we all kind of groaned, it seemed like, when we saw him trot onto the field last year. But he did have one of the most important plays, one of the biggest games of the season, and did, you know, do a lot of things well. But like most, when things go wrong, that tends to be when people pay attention, not when things go right. So really, really happy
Absolutely.
For a kid who, by all accounts, is a really great kid, a really hard worker, and very, very beloved by his teammates. So that was really nice to hear this week.
Yeah, it definitely was. And, you know, you mentioned it too. It's part of the family feel at TCU. And I think it's a testament to, you know, the character of the coaching staff that they would look at these guys who have just worked so hard to be a part of this thing and give them kind of the recognition that they deserve for that work. Because, you know, frankly, it's guys like this that make any good football team tick, because they are the ones who are on the scout team. They are the ones who are watching film just as much as the kind of those heroes and the superstars to make sure that they do their jobs well enough to get everyone else prepared. And it goes without saying that, you know, the guys that do that, those workhorses, you know, good teams wouldn't be as good if their scout teams and all of these guys who get little recognition weren't doing their jobs as best they could.
Absolutely. Very well said.
You know, Patterson did say in his press conference that Kenny Iloka is not 100%. He's not at full speed yet, but he hopes that he will be at some point this season, which does not exactly instill confidence in me that Kenny will be ready to get back out onto the field. Patterson did say that he would be on the field in a special teams role, which, you know, is slightly ironic because that's how he got hurt last year. He did tear his ACL covering a kickoff last year. But Melissa, you know, my concern at this point is when guys like Kenny don't get back healthy, you know, on schedule or when we expect them to, you know, what does that do for them, their mentality? You know, we saw this with Deontay Gray a little bit last year, I think, too. He was physically fine, but there were some questions about, was he, you know, ready
mentally?
Iloka is not physically fully healthy, but if he does, say, 4 or 5 games into the season, how long is that kind of catch-up time for the mind to get back to where it needs to be for them to go out and really just let it all out and cut it loose? You know, and so, you know, I just, my concern for him is that even if he does come back this year, you know, what kind of player is TCU going to be getting back? And in his absence, what does his absence do to TCU's depth at secondary? Because it's another young part of the team, or these guys playing these three safety spots. So I don't know. I don't know what your thoughts are on that, but I have a depth concern now at secondary, just knowing that Iloka is not fully back.
Well, and this may be because, if for those of you guys listening, if you have not met Kenny Iloka, I honestly don't know that there is a player I enjoy talking to in my entire TC-related history than this young man. He is bright. He's engaging. He's hilarious. I've had a chance to talk to him and have, like, fairly significant conversations with him the last 2 years at the Women's Football Clinic in July that's held at TCU. And this kid is the real deal. Just an absolute – the exact kind of kid you want representing your university as a football player or a student, period. He's awesome. He has a role in coaching or as an ambassador for the school or something in the future after what will hopefully be a long pro career for him. So I really, really like the kid just as a person and as a football player. And so I spoke to him in July, asked him how, you know, the healing was coming along, how the knee was coming along, where he was mentally, and you know, kind of just asked him that question of, hey, you know, are you coming back? Are you 100%? You know, do you feel like you're ready? Is this kind of a Deontay Gray situation? And he said he felt really confident mentally, that he didn't think that was going to be a problem, and that he felt when he was 100% that he'd be ready to step back on the field without being worried about having, you know, having the mind part of that hold him back. He's an incredibly smart player. So I don't think that even if it takes them a couple weeks to come back in the season, that's going to hold them up too much. You know, obviously you can't replicate game snaps on the practice field, and you can't replicate them with the mental reps either. But I don't think he'll have too much of a wall to climb once he is able to get back on the field before he's actually ready to play at a high level. He's incredibly physically gifted. So assuming that he does come back 100% healthy, I think that he'll step right into that role and end up being the player that we had seen him be at the beginning of last season before he was, you know, unfortunately hurt in the second game against SFA. So I don't worry too much about him. I don't worry too much about him being ready to go when his time comes. And the fact that he's playing special teams, I think, shows me that mentally he is confident. It's just going to be a matter of being able to make those quick adjustments on the fly and see that game at full speed that seems to be holding him back at this time. So I think that the true concern, like you said, is the depth behind him. Because without Julius Lewis, you know, without Kenny Loco being 100%, if you look on the depth chart, you're looking at that, lo and behold, there's Michael Downing's name again. So he could be the guy backing up Nick Orr to start the season at weak safety. So I'm hopeful that we'll see Aloko take a couple snaps, maybe in the second half on Saturday at the safety position, that, you know, he's able to get a few more under his belt against Arkansas, and hopefully by Iowa State or SMU, he's at 100%, because he's a guy that not only is great as an individual player, but is that kind of Sam Carter type leader in the back end of the defense for Gary Patterson, kind of that coach on the field. And I think we really do need him to fill that role to have the CCU defense be as good as it can be.
Yeah, you know, I like that you've had an opportunity to sit down with Kenny and chat for a little bit. That makes me happy that, you know, he is such a smart kid and such a talented kid. And all signs are pointing to him, you know, coming back at some point this season full strength. So that's good. And the secondary definitely will be better off for him being there. Melissa, I realized that we kind of wandered away from the TCU South Dakota State game without making kind of a prediction on how that game turns out. Are you willing at this point to make a call on how you think that game turns out?
Yeah, you know, I'll throw it out there. I won't even refer back to my notes of what I sent you for our official Frogs of War predictions earlier today, which I did not italicize. Sorry, Jamie.
But I got so called much out on editing.
My on that. Yeah, so much editing. I'll get better, maybe. But I think, like I said, I think it could be a little bit too close for comfort on the early going. I think that defense, just as they get up to gear, may play just a little bit on their heels to start things off. But I see the Frogs putting up 6 touchdowns. God help us if we have to kick field goals. But I'm thinking something in the realm of 42-17 or so. You know, it's probably 24-13 at the half. That would not add up correctly numbers-wise, Big 12 math. It's probably 28-14 at the half. And then TCU, you know, puts a couple more scores on the board before taking their foot off the gas midway through the third quarter and letting Foster Sawyer get some snaps to finish things off.
Gosh, if it's 28-14 at halftime, I'm going to be really concerned, because that means that either the offense isn't clicking well, or the offense is fine, but South Dakota State has some elite level defense and scheme that we don't really know about yet. I was kind of being a negative Nancy earlier. Or a negative Neil. It doesn't have to be a woman that's being negative. We're gender equal. All about gender equality here.
Wow.
I was being a negative Neil. Yeah, I'm doing great. I think that Kenny Hill comes out confident, understanding his role in the offense, which is to not try to do too much, but really just get the ball where it needs to be and get it there on time, and really let the rest of his offense pad his stats for him. You know, when you've got guys like Kevontae Turpin and Deontay Gray that you're throwing the ball to, all you've got to do is get it to him in stride, and they can take care of the rest. So I'm going to be really looking for Kenny Hill to do that, and I think that if he does, TCU just jumps on him early and really doesn't look back. And we see Foster Sawyer come out to start the second half. I think that, the Frogs are going to go into the half probably somewhere around 35 or 38 to, you know, anywhere from like 6 to 10, you know, Big 12 math. And so with the final score, with the backups in there, running clock in the fourth quarter, somewhere around like 56 to 13, 56 to 17, somewhere in that range. And I think that that would be a reasonable victory for a game like this against an FCS team that is decent, but is still just really out of their league coming into Fort Worth playing a team like TCU.
Well, you know what's amazing to me is that we're 45 minutes into this podcast, and that is the first time that one of us has uttered the words Kevontae Turpin. And that is a shame.
Jeez.
Because
that is really
how,
a shame. Because
I don't
that
know that there is
fire.
Anybody I'm more excited. Yeah, I mean, as fun as it's going to be to watch Kenny Hill play this year and to see what he can do and as much mystery as there is surrounding that position, same time, I don't know that there is a guy I am more excited to see on the field this year than Kevontae Turpin. Deontay Gray is a close second for me. To see him back and explosive, but Turpin is set to have just an absolute amazing sophomore campaign. I'd be worried about him having a sophomore slump, except there's so much talent around him that I just don't think teams are going to be able to focus on him the way they need to keep him bottled up. So he is ready for just an absolute breakout year, I think, for the second time in a row.
Yeah, I don't think there's any chance of regression, certainly, because with the loss of Josh Doctson on one hand, and then kind of the re-addition of Deontay Gray into the mix and Ty Slanina, who was hurt last year for the majority of the season. You know, you've got so many weapons, and you don't have that one really front-running weapon that the defense has to focus on, which means that they're not going to be able to overload to one side or the other because of the talent that is just spread across the entire field. And I think that that's going to open up a lot for Turpin this year. I would not be totally shocked if he had, you know, I think his baseline for a quality year in his second year on this team is somewhere around 1,000 to 1,100 yards receiving and like 10 to 12 touchdowns. I mean, the kid last year had 700 yards receiving. Well, he had 700 yards receiving and 8 touchdowns as a true freshman. I mean, if we're talking about improving on that, I mean, you're talking about some legit wide receiver one numbers, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's crazy to think of a guy who is maybe 5'8" and 150 pounds being a legit number one receiver for a Power 5 team. I mean, that just really speaks just the talent that this kid has.
Well, he is an elite talent, at least speed-wise. He's got great hands. He showed us that last year. He's got the ability to move his body in the air like he's a 6'4" receiver. He's like Josh Doctson, he's like a faster, smaller Josh Doctson.
Yeah. And he's got a couple of offensive-minded coaches who understand how to use him and to get him the ball in space. And that really is the key. And I think what you said about Kenny Hill is 100% true. For TCU to be successful, not just against South Dakota State, but against the entirety of their schedule, Kenny Hill is going to have to trust, if I put the ball in my receiver's hands, they're going to pad my stats for me. It doesn't need to be about him making all the plays. It just needs to be about him delivering the ball in a timely fashion and letting his incredibly talented receiving core do the rest of the work. So if he plays within himself, he could have a huge monster season, starting with a huge monster game against the Jackrabbits.
Exactly. And then, you know, just to keep the offense balanced, give it to Kyle Hicks like 15 to 18 times and just let him pound away at everyone.
Yes. I think he's primed for a breakout year as well, as I think has been well documented. So it's going to be really fun to watch him work and to see how he fills, you know, the incredibly big shoes of Aaron Green, who looks like he may have a chance to stick around in LA, hopefully. So
it looks like it. It looks, you know, the very, very, you know, odd Trey Mason situation that's happening over there seems to open up a spot. And then his, you know, Green's ability that he's been flashing to catch passes out of the backfield and his willingness to play special teams, stick his nose in on pass blocking situations. You know, he's kind of making himself into one of those invaluable assets, just those, you know, utility knife kind of players that every team loves to have.
So, absolutely.
But, you know, we're obviously all excited for TCU South Dakota State this weekend. I have been wearing TCU apparel pretty much the last 3 days straight at work. I had someone at my office to ask me if I was wearing the same shirt 2 days in a row. I was like, no, it's just I got a lot of purple, friend. So, it is a clean shirt, I promise. I do wash my shirts after each wear, because hygiene is important.
Good, but it's good to know.
It's not the only football game that's happening, though, on this big first weekend of college football. I know our whole world tends to revolve around TCU, but other football teams are playing. And there are some really, really good matchups, especially in the Big 12. So I wanted to get to a couple of those before we start taking calls. We will be taking calls tonight, listeners, because we love you and we want to hear from you. The guest call-in line is 657-383-1319. That is 657-383-1319. We'll take your calls in just a few minutes. But first, I wanted to talk a little bit, Melissa, about some of these Big 12 matchups that we're seeing in Week 1. And I wanted to start with a couple hours south down in Austin, Texas. Texas is hosting Notre Dame. This is a game that did not go well for the Longhorns last year by any stretch of the imagination. And I don't particularly see it going any better for them this year. I don't know about you, Melissa, but yes, Notre Dame lost some key players who made terrible decisions late last week. But Texas still doesn't have a quarterback, as far as I know. Just generally offensively, they don't really seem to have much going on. And it's really hard to win when your team's not scoring a whole lot of points. They realized that last year, when they lost to us 50-7, when they got shut out by Iowa State, and obviously when they got blasted by Notre Dame. So when you hear about this matchup Week 1, Melissa, what are your kind of initial thoughts?
I think Notre Dame is the better football team right now. I think there is frighteningly potential for Texas to be the better of the two teams at the end of the season once they get this whole quarterback thing squared away. I think it's interesting that they have not named a starter yet, and actually was just had a picture with me of Shane Buechele talking with Matthew McConaughey. So that's what's happening in Austin right now, by the way. But I don't know what you are for message board rumors, especially message board rumors that come from Aggies. But apparently there is some movement in Austin.
Message board rumors that come from Aggies.
They're the only reliable source of information. They do give us life. Well, the rumor out of College Station in regards to Austin, since they're not obsessed with the Longhorns or anything, is that the players are pushing for Tyrone Soups to start game one, which makes me concerned that there may be an outbreak of the Zika virus or something in Austin, if that's who the Texas players are pushing for right now. That is the case, then I don't know what Shane Buechele has possibly done wrong, because by all accounts out of practice, he has been impressive on the field. I don't know if it's the worry of we got housed a year ago and embarrassed by Notre Dame, and putting a true freshman quarterback up against Brian Kelly in that defense might not work out well for them at home. Or if it's that they still look at Tyrone Soups as the leader in the clubhouse and want to see him get one last shot to keep the job. So the running game in Texas is legit. The offensive line should be good. They have a couple of really dynamic, impressive wide receivers. It's not out of the realm of possibility that this could be a fourth quarter game and Texas could pull it off at home. I just don't see that happening. I think it's an ugly loss. I think it's a 20-point plus loss. And I think that Charlie Strong is going to start out the season fighting for his job from, maybe the fourth or fifth snap, knowing that things could go downhill really, really quickly. That being said, I do think I'm not quite on the Texas is a dark horse Big 12 contender, but they do have a ton of talent on the defensive side of the ball, and they do seem to have kind of bought into Charlie Strong's attitude in the locker room. So you could see them surprise some people this year, but it's not going to start against Notre Dame.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I did not hear that rumor about Swoops. That's terrifying if you're a Texas fan, I think, that –
yeah,
players are pushing for him to be the starter. Now, I don't have a live feed into Texas's summer camp, so I didn't see him throwing the ball. But if he would have had to improve as much as Boykin improved from 2013 to 2014, which, Texas does have a new offensive coordinator this season, so it might be a system that fits him better. But there would need to be that level of improvement from Swoops, for me to have any kind of confidence as a Texas fan in him being able to be the starter of this team and being able to be effective. And that's just me. And that signals that there are some big problems that still need to be worked out down in Texas. And so I'm not buying. I know a lot of folks are this offseason, but I'm not buying Texas this year at all.
Well, and there may be that whole movement too of, we sure would like Tom Herman in Austin. And we may see this team quit early if they don't like the way things are going to try to, you know, tank for Tom. Which, I think I just invented a hashtag.
Hey, tanking for Tom. That will be sweeping the nation come
it's
November.
It's going to be sweeping at least 3 schools in Texas, so at least 3.
You better jump on it. You better trademark that quickly.
Yep.
You know, we saw what happened with her to Omaha.
Yeah. So. Yeah, right? Or, yeah, I can. Maybe I'll see what Daylon Mack's parents have to say about that, or Kenny Hill's.
Oh, man. Yeah, so I'm picking Notre Dame in that game. I don't have a score for you, but I'm picking Notre Dame.
So, what's game number 2? Turn our attention to Kansas State, Stanford.
Yes, Friday night matchup. Kansas State. I've really liked some of these early season matchups for Kansas State in the past few years. You know, they had Auburn, and now they have Stanford. They are they're playing people early, and I think it all the favors in the world, especially if they come out with a win in this one. I'm not totally sure that they will.
They will.
Because Stanford is a great team. Kansas State is not that great, especially on the offensive side of the ball. And the game is in California, isn't it?
It is. It is at Stanford.
Yeah, I would give them about the same chance of beating Stanford as I give Texas a chance of beating Notre Dame.
And I would give them even
the
less. Texas at least get the Irish at home.
I think you're buying Texas a little bit more than I am at this point.
I'm just really not buying Kansas State.
Okay.
I think they'll be fine in the Big 12. I think they'll hover right around 500 in the conference. But I think Stanford is really, really good. You know, I saw them against Iowa at the Rose Bowl. I've got some family ties to Stanford, so I'm completely and totally biased. Unless they play TCU, at which point, sorry, family, you're done. But I do think that Christian McCaffrey is bitter that he didn't finish a little bit higher in the Heisman voting and have a chance to legitimately win that thing. I think we're about to see like a 4,000-yard season from this kid. So I'm really excited to see what he does. Kansas State will never be bad as long as Bill Snyder is there. So they'll compete, they'll play hard, but at the end of the day, I think Stanford is just going to run them over on both sides of the ball and having to make that long trip out west. I think the Cardinal will make a statement early.
Yeah, you know, Melissa, I have a confession to make at this point. I feel like this is an appropriate time to make this confession. I was not a buyer when it came to Christian McCaffrey last season.
Ooh.
Until I came around, okay, this is a resurrection story. It has a happy ending. I came around on him when I watched the Rose Bowl. It was the first time I saw him play all year, but I was like, there's no way that this kid who is just returning kickoffs, in my head, I was totally misguided. He's just returning kickoffs. I watched him play in that Rose Bowl game, and he just absolutely obliterated. Yeah. Who was it? Was it Iowa that they played?
Iowa, just from the first snap.
I
got to watch him play Northwestern. I got to watch him play Iowa, and I'll watch him play Washington State this year in person. And he's real. He's legit.
Yeah. Well, let's move on. We got a couple more games that I'd like to talk about. If your game before we start taking calls, and we do have someone on the line already. So, Oklahoma, Houston, this is a really interesting matchup, I think, Melissa, because Oklahoma is traveling to Houston. They're playing at NRG Stadium, which is where the Texans play. And, you know, Greg Ward Jr. and this Houston offense are supposed to be fantastic again this year. Oklahoma is supposed to have a pretty good defense again this year. This is a game that if I'm an Oklahoma fan, I'm looking at it, and then I'm looking at the next week against Ohio State, and I'm like, why? Why is this a thing that we decided to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the biggest game on the schedule for the Big 12 conference. I mean, far and away, especially when you look at Houston as being a contender for one of those, you know, two spots that could be 12 spots, who knows at this point. I think I want to pick Houston. I think Houston has a lot to prove, and I think they'll play like they have a lot to prove. And, you know, Tom Herman has put enough swagger into that program that I don't think the stage will be too big for them. It's an 11 a.m. game, which is always a little bit tougher for the quote-unquote road team, which, you know, OU technically is. But there's just something about a pissed-off Baker Mayfield, and with all of the hype surrounding, even though Oklahoma is a higher-ranked team, even though Baker Mayfield is the higher Heisman contender, even though OU is the Big 12 contender, and so there's really no reason to have a chip on your shoulder, Baker. You know that all he can hear is the one person on Twitter who said they didn't think he was good enough to beat Houston. So I feel like there's this alternate reality where all Baker Mayfield does is search his name on Twitter all day, every day. Like, maybe he stopped for 2 hours to practice football, but I'm pretty sure all he does is just make a file of the haters. I just see him in a dark room with a Rolodex and one like half burnt out lamp, just making files of people that disrespected him. So I just don't see
it. I wonder how he crosses people off of that list. Does he do it like Steve Buscemi's character in Billy Madison, or you know, he's got the lipstick?
Yeah,
he's just like crossing it out, and then he puts some lipstick on, and you know, he's cleaning his rifle. Yeah.
Yes, 100%. That's what it is. Except Gary Patterson never gets crossed off. So I don't see any way that OU loses this game. I'm not saying that Houston can't beat them and that Houston isn't good of a team. This is just one of those Baker Mayfield specials where he's going to come out in all of his glory and just run all over this team. Now, I think I picked against them, which probably I'm sure he knows and is really upset about. But if OU comes out of these first two games with a 1-1 split, they're in really, really great shape for the playoffs, obviously. But I think they take game one, and frankly, you know, selfishly, I'd like to see them roll into Fort Worth undefeated with those two skins on the belt so that we can beat them and have it mean that much more.
Yeah. You know, I definitely would like to see OU come out of their non-conference schedule unscathed, because like that October 1st game could be for the Big 12.
Yeah.
And you want them looking their best when they come into Fort Worth. The last kind of intriguing Big 12 matchup that I have listed here, Melissa, is West Virginia against Mizzou. For no other reason than I just like to see the Big 12 go up against the SEC and see how they handle themselves. I'm not really expecting too much from West Virginia this year, but you know, Missouri has had a lot of turnover in the past offseason, and I don't really know what to expect from them either. So this could be an opportunity for the Big 12 to kind of get one of those, you know, kind of mid-tier marquee wins over an SEC team that has done pretty well since joining the SEC. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of the sneaky important games. I don't think it's a big, you know, it's not a big deal if Kansas State takes a loss to Stanford. You know, if OU drops a close one to Houston in Houston, that's not going to hurt anybody. But West Virginia has a chance over a struggling Missouri program. Like, football team's still pretty good. The program as a whole has been under some fire here lately. So for West Virginia to come out and get a win against Mizzou would be huge for them, would be huge for Dana Holgorsen, and would make a nice statement for the Big 12 to take that SEC, you know, team down a notch. So I think it's an important early season game on a lot of fronts, and I definitely think it's one that West Virginia has to win. I think they are the better team. I think they're the more experienced team, especially at the quarterback position. So hopefully the Ears can take care of business early and put down an SEC team in the preseason.
Do you think Holgorsen is coaching for his job this year?
Yes, 100%.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think that this is a game that if he wants to stay in Morgantown, that this is a game he really needs to win.
Absolutely.
Because I don't know how they're going to do in the Big 12 this year, and this is one that's there for the taking, I think.
Yeah, it's going to be rough. They do scare me in Morgantown in October, though. That is definitely one of the games I have circled.
In our big preview, you know, I put that graphic together with everybody's picks, and I think it was, you know, six people picked TCU to win and five picked West Virginia, and that was by far the most people that game was the most picked for TCU to lose from the Big
12. It's a tough game. I mean, Morgantown is a tough place to play, and if there is a team other than Texas Tech that wants revenge more than the Mountaineers, I don't know who it is.
Yeah. You know, last year, was the first time since TCU and West Virginia joined the Big 12. It was the first time that either of those teams beat the other team when hosting that team.
Yeah.
I really cornered myself with my sentence structure there.
That was really, really bad.
Prior to last season, the team had won every game in the TCU-West Virginia matchup, and that streak was broken last year when TCU won at home. So hopefully we go back to that road team winning bit 2016.
Yes, absolutely.
I do want to talk about some other national matchups, Melissa, but we got a friend of ours, Kyle, on the line, and so I want to bring him on and let him ask his awesome rapid-fire questions just like he did last week. Kyle, hello.
Hey, guys. Good to be back again.
Hello, Kyle.
Hello.
I'm very glad to have
How
you
How is
back.
Everyone?
Oh, fabulous.
So well.
All right.
Doing so.
So, yeah, I got some questions. We ready?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
And not the same format, but I thought some would lead to some conversation. So which team do you each feel the Frogs have to beat this season for you not to cry afterwards? So you got one team, we have to beat them. Who is it?
I tell my students, as those of you that don't know, I'm a high school teacher. I tell my students on a Monday, if TCU loses, just don't talk to me about football. I just don't want to hear about it. If TCU loses to Baylor, give me a week minimum. So it doesn't matter what's going on the field, off the field. That is the one loss that I can't talk myself into it being okay. So I still get a little bit vomity when I think about what happened 2 years ago. So that's the one. I mean, I'd love to beat OU. It won't crush me if we play a great game and lose. Texas Tech would suck and I'd hate to hear it, but Baylor is always going to be the team that I just can't stomach losing to for a variety of reasons.
Yeah, you know, I want to say someone different. If it wasn't Baylor, it is Baylor. But if it wasn't Baylor, it would be SMU. And it would be especially SMU this season.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, they're trying to get into the Big 12. And if they beat TCU this year, they could say, hey, we've already beaten a Big 12 team this year. Why don't you just go ahead and, you know, put that on our resume and let us on in. So, you know, I have this like irrational fear that SMU would beat TCU this year and then get invited to the Big 12.
Yeah.
And then be a conference mate of ours. And I don't like that. But no, you know, it's Baylor. It's absolutely Baylor, unequivocally. I hate them more than anyone else. And so, yes, Baylor is my answer.
I actually do agree with you both. I would imagine the majority of Frog fans, well, maybe Frogs of War readers would agree with that too. But I've been asking a lot of people this question, and someone actually mentioned Iowa State, and I was like, that's out of nowhere. Like, that doesn't make any sense. And so his reasoning was, if we lose to Iowa State, then that probably means we've had a terrible season. We've also lost to a bunch of other teams.
That's true. But at that point, we'd be so beat. Well, I guess that would be early in the year. So that would be like the harbinger of horrible things to come. We lost to Iowa State at home. Yeah, that would be rough. And I have an Iowa State coworker who would never let me forget it. So I don't want it to live like that.
All right. So on the flip side, name a team. You know, God forbid we lose, but, you know, no team's ever gone undefeated in the Big 12. That if we did lose to them, it wouldn't be the end of the world.
Oklahoma? I mean, like, that's kind of where I am, but I also feel like that could be the game that really sets us off like it did 2 years ago to a really special season. So I would say one of the two Oklahoma teams, like, I mean, Oklahoma, if they come in still a top five team, you know, if they beat Houston and Ohio State and we lose a tightly fought battle, we don't get the doors blown off at home, but it's a close one. I could stomach that. Like, I'm already talking myself into that. And the other one would be, you know, maybe West Virginia at West Virginia, just because I don't feel like the Mountaineers fans are the worst people in the world. And I don't feel like they'd make my life absolutely miserable on the internet for weeks afterwards. So that's usually my thing. It's like, how awful am I going to feel for the next 2 weeks after a TCU loss based on how people treat me on the internet? So, yeah, I guess either of those I could stomach depending on how it went down.
I like both of those. I think I'm going to go with Arkansas, though. I think y'all both know this at this point. Listeners, most of you listeners probably know this. I grew up an Arkansas fan. My dad is a huge Razorback. And so I did love that team a lot growing up. So just for, you know, personal reasons, seeing them beat TCU, I mean, it would, I would hate it, but I think I would recover pretty quickly. And also, you know, that doesn't affect TCU's chances to win the Big 12, which is, you know, I think a big deal, because if you lose to Arkansas in week two and then you get your crap together and let that motivate you through the rest of the season, you know, you could see a TCU team that was 11-1 winning the Big 12 and then still having a shot at the playoffs, right? So losing to Arkansas doesn't totally decimate your end of season hopes, even though it would be a disappointing loss.
I agree with that. At first, I was thinking Oklahoma because obviously, you know, you lose to them, it's not embarrassing. They're a top five team right now. But if we want to win the Big 12, I think we have to beat them. I don't really know if there's another option. If we don't, then that means they have to lose twice, and I don't see that happening. So I was going to pick somebody else, not named TCU. Exactly. So I was thinking somebody else like West Virginia or even Tech, which I would hate that. I don't want Tech fans, but if that was the only loss, I feel like it's early enough in the season, we might be able to recover. So, and all right, so moving on. We haven't even played a game yet, but which senior, so looking ahead, which senior do you think you'll miss the most next year? So we only have a few, which is amazing.
Yeah.
Deontay Gray, Collins on the line, McFarland and Caraway. You guys already talked about Aloka for a while tonight. Aaron Curry, or I think Denzel Johnson, and I may be missing somebody, but we don't have a lot to talk about, so it's crazy.
Yeah, I think, gosh, you know, I mean, off the top of my head, my gut instinct was Caraway.
Mm.
But at the same time, you know, you've got Isaiah Chambers backing him up. You've got Matt Boson. You've got Tipa. You've got all of this young depth that can kind of alleviate a loss of someone like him, and pretty much, again, you know, a loss of anyone along the defensive line. Deontay Gray would be a bummer, but you've got Kevontae Turpin. You've got Desmond White. Gosh, that's a good question.
I think maybe not from on the field, because we do have a lot of depth behind these guys, you know, a lot of freshmen, sophomores that look like they're ready to play roles. From a locker room standpoint, James McFarland may be, you know, kind of the leader of that senior group as far as a vocal presence in the locker room and someone his teammates really respect and listen to. Even when he was hurt last year, from what I understand, he was still a pretty vocal presence when he had the opportunity to be so. So, I think he's a, you know, and again, him and Kenny Aloka, just two of, if you guys ever see any of their interviews, I mean, just two of the best interviews you're going to get, you know, from any TCU player in any sport. Just really down-to-earth, humble guys that give a great quote and love to have, you know, a good laugh too. So those would probably be the two from a locker room standpoint. From a production standpoint, you know, Caraway is just such a unique talent at defensive end. You would imagine that Tipa or Isaiah Chambers will be able to step in and fill that role. But he really has developed so much in his time on campus to become really a special player that, you know, it will be sad to see him go from an on-field production standpoint for sure.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree. I think McFarland, just what he's meant to those guys in the locker room, that's going to be a big loss next year. And it always seems like losing senior leadership in the secondary, you know, at least momentarily sets the whole unit back a little bit. You know, you saw it with Sam Carter when he left. He was such a fantastic leader off the field. And now you do have guys like Aloka and Johnson who are phenomenal folks as well. So, you know, I don't know that I can name anyone, Kyle, but, you know, you always kind of are bummed to see a senior class go, just because they've meant so much to this program and they've helped build something that we all love so much.
So, yeah, and this may change, you know, throughout the season or maybe at the end when one of these guys actually steps up. And like you mentioned, Sam Carter, I mean, I don't really know if I would have said, oh, man, I'm going to hate to lose this guy until the end of the season, you know, when you realize what impact he made.
Mm-hmm.
So reversing that, which true freshman are you most excited about? Just one. I know we have a lot of options for breakout players this year, but true freshman that might actually see the field this year, which one are you most excited about watching?
Oh, Gosh.
Man, there are some really exciting guys that are
there
freshmen.
Are. I think I'm going to have to go with Ross Blacklock just because I love watching big dudes battle in the trenches and just the, you know, physical specimen that he is. And for all reports, just how talented he is. When he steps onto that field, you know, I'm going to be keeping an eye on him. So I'm going to go with, yeah, Ross Blacklock.
I'll go on the other side of the ball and go another big dude rumbling and go with Sewu. I don't know how this kid's going to get used. I don't know what his role is going to be. I just know when he has the ball in his hands and he starts running downhill, it's going to be a lot of fun to watch. So I'm really, really excited to see how Cumbie and Meechan deploy him. Again, they're going to like it so much.
Yeah, definitely.
It'll be interesting to see if he and like Anderson get meaningful touches. You know, they're gonna get touches, but
with the
real number one, it'll be interesting if they're not just in there for junk time or for like goal line. You know,
plays. the way that Patterson talked about Darius Anderson, it did not sound like a kid that was only gonna do mop up duty. He really liked him, and he's a lot bigger than I thought he was. You know, he's not a 170-pound guy. Like, he's, I think, a legit 200 pounds or close to it. So, he's ready to play.
He's the same height. He's the same height as Trevoris Johnson and Derek Green.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's also one of those guys that just has crazy top-end speed. So, he's got that full package. Yeah.
So, my answer to this one is Vernon Scott.
Oh, good answer. Good answer.
So he's true freshman. Rarely do they get mentioned, you know, by Patterson.
Mm-hmm.
He's also taller than any of the cornerbacks, the good cornerbacks we've had recently, with Tejada, who's what, 5'10", 5'11". I mean, even Verrett was under 6 feet, you know, and Vernon Scott's what, like 6'2". So if he's already making an impact as a true freshman, I mean, I feel like he could be the next breakout, you know, lockdown corner.
Absolutely. It's a great call. Ennis Gaines is another guy, too, at the safety position that, if Aloka isn't 100%, could see some meaningful snaps early. He's pretty exciting.
Well, thanks, guys. That's all I got.
Hey, thanks for calling in, Kyle.
Hey, thanks for calling in, Kyle. We really appreciate it, bud.
Pleasure to chat. Good night.
Jimmy, all
right,
brother. Meanwhile, while those great questions were being given to us from our great listener, Kyle, the Big 12 expansion list has grown. It now includes Rice. Yeah, so,
Rice
has made the cut. So
Rice.
This is, yeah, Rice, according to, I think it was Jake Trotter who tweeted that out.
Oh,
it just gets better and better. You know what?
6-8. They're looking really good.
Let's have an all-Texas conference. You know, I've been working on an article about this. I haven't quite gotten it together, but I think let's just invite every team in Texas and just make the Big 12 an all-Texas, all-the-time conference.
Oh, it hurts me. It hurts me to think that this is the leadership of the conference that can't even narrow down a list without 7 different numbers being leaked. Like, there's really – it's just, the future is so bleak. The future is so bleak. Especially if Rice is one of your finalists or semifinalists or whatever. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, and I also saw Tulane mentioned in that tweet, so.
They still are in, yeah, okay.
yeah. So, well, I mean, it's, who knows? It keeps changing. So, I think that if you've ever had a football program, you made that cut of 12, even though there's about, you know, 128 teams that can say that.
Yeah. Well, let's turn our attention to some teams that definitely will never, ever, ever join the Big 12 and get back to some more of these week one matchups that are pretty intriguing. What do you say?
That sounds good to me.
So one that's on the list that I'm definitely going to be tuning in for, or at least recording and going back and watching, is the Wisconsin-LSU matchup. You know, Leonard Fournette tweaked his ankle a little bit early on in camp, early August. Seems to be working his way back pretty well. But this is, you know, another one of those SEC Big Ten matchups that, you know, we've had, I think that, you know, media has had a hard time predicting in the past. I don't really know what to feel. I don't really know how to feel about this game.
I'm going to have no problem predicting that this is going to be an ugly one for Wisconsin, which I hate to say because, you know, we've I don't want to pick on the Badgers here, and it is at Lambeau Field. I just think, you know, LSU is obviously the trendy preseason playoff pick, is a trendy SEC champion pick this year. Brandon Harris came such a long way, and of course, the Tigers have Wisconsin's old defensive coordinator who did a really, really good job for the Badgers with not a lot of big-name talent the last couple of seasons. So Clement is a great running back. I don't know. I couldn't even tell you the name of the guy that's going to be the quarterback for Wisconsin this year. I guess I should be more prepared on that. But I just don't think Bucky's going to be able to score enough to keep LSU and their what could be a potentially powerful offense off the field and come away with a win. I think it's going to be an easy one for Les Miles, and he's going to start working his way back to job security.
Yeah, that was a crazy story last year, that his job was in jeopardy. I never understood that. Speaking of Les Miles, though, did you see what he came out and said today about his team? So he said that if any of his players decided after they scored a touchdown to do the traditional Lambeau leap, that they would be immediately pulled from the game and handed a bus ticket back to Louisiana.
Seriously? Let the kids leap. I mean,
let the kids play.
Most of these kids are never, ever, ever going to take a snap at Lambeau Field ever again in their lives. Let them leap. I think start a movement. Let them leap.
Here's the thing, though. I mean, if they're leaping in the wrong wall, they're jumping into Wisconsin fans anyways. I mean,
True.
I know that LSU fans travel well and that they're just a boatload of them. But what do you really think, like, the fan percentage is going to be in Lambeau for that game?
I bet it's only 60-40. I bet it's 60-40 Badgers.
Really?
Yeah, but don't worry. You'll still be able to smell the corn dogs.
Oh, it's so gross. It's so disgusting.
Man,
Wisconsin
so true,
fans, that is a group of people that I will never forget encountering from the Rose Bowl. And that was they're a unique brand of human being.
I'll tell you what. Yeah, that's I've never been flipped off by such a large contingent all at once before during national anthem. So
they were not interested in paying their respects. They went more the Colin Kaepernick route.
Right. Actually, it would have been better off if they had. It was a little more violent than that.
Sitting down in silence. Looks so bad.
Oh, so bad. Yeah, that was fun. I have a couple of Wisconsin coworkers too. So anytime they start to talk about how good their team looks, I just have to say the words Rose Bowl and we're just fine.
Just shut them right down.
Yep, shut them right down.
Awesome. Yeah, probably puts you down a notch in their friend list, but you can do
that.
That's
okay. No new friends, right? No new friends. Marshall status.
Exactly.
So what about the other big game happening in DFW this weekend? It's not quite the magnitude of TCU San Diego State, but there are a couple traditional powers rolling into Jerry World on Saturday night, right?
Yeah, I definitely think TCU South Dakota State is the bigger of the two matchups when you compare it to USC and Alabama. There's no doubt. You know, just the legend that is the South Dakota State Jackrabbits cannot be overstated. Alabama, there's a rumor out there that they might just be starting a true freshman at quarterback.
Yeah.
And somehow I don't feel like that is going to deter them from winning at least 10 or 11 games this year.
Yep.
Because it's just what they do. They're Alabama. Meanwhile, on the other side of the ball, I know that you're a Cali, you know, I know that you're a Cali person, but I'm not buying USC. I can't do it.
You need to know I'm a Northern California person. Ergo, I have no affinity towards the Trojans other than people I know that go there.
When I go out of state, I will say this about me. When I go out of state and people learn that I am from Texas, whenever we talk, sports in general, I will tend to defend the Texas team regardless. Now, if it's Baylor, all bets are off. Texas Tech, all bets are off. But if it's UT or A&M or Houston or the Frogs or SMU, I tend to be a little bit more lenient in conversation with out-of-state.
Wow.
So I didn't know if you're the same way.
I didn't peg you as that guy. Jeez.
Well, I have. It's all about grace. It's all about respecting the other. And so I try to be kind when I'm in conversations with folks out of state about the other Texas schools. Now, you and I both know how I really feel about all of them.
True.
But I didn't know if you were similar, except with California schools.
No, definitely not. Yeah, no, I have very little affinity for many of the California collegiate teams that I don't have a direct relation to. So, and I have never been a USC fan. One of my greatest collegiate moments was seeing TCU beat them in the Sun Bowl. That meant a lot to me as a Northern Californian. Quite a rivalry between the two halves of the state as well, for people that aren't familiar with California. Going back to many, many years of drought in the 80s and fighting over water. But so I have no general affinity to USC. I rooted hard against them in the Texas Rose Bowl. That's the only time I've really rooted for Texas against an opponent. So I like Juju Schuster-Smith. One of the names, he's probably a little underrated nationally, to be honest, but a really exciting, fun, young wide receiver. But I don't think they have the quarterback talent this year. I don't think they have quite the maturity on the defensive side of the ball to handle an Alabama team that basically runs like a professional organization at this point. And I think it's going to be ugly for the Trojans. They may compete in the Pac-12 South this year, but they're going to get run off the field, unfortunately, in Dallas here this weekend. Not Dallas,
yeah,
Arlington. I live in Arlington. I need to call it Arlington.
Your taxes paid for that beautiful stadium.
Right? Yep, they did indeed.
So, yeah, I agree. Alabama's going to roll Tide, I guess. Next game, last game that I wanted to talk about tonight. If you've got another one, feel free to throw it in here as we're nearing the end of our show. It's Florida State Ole Miss. It's a very interesting matchup with two teams that are very highly ranked coming into the season. There are a lot of high expectations around both of these teams, you know. Florida State, I think the expectation is that they will be the challenger in the ACC to kind of knock off Clemson. And Ole Miss, you know, just competing in that very, very powerful SEC West, mm-hmm. Has high expectations for their squad as well. How do you see this game turning out?
You know, it's an interesting matchup, like you said. Ole Miss has had quite a bit of kerfuffle around them off the field, but yet somehow it's kind of flown under the radar this offseason thanks to some bigger news going on. The college football mm-hmm. landscape. I think they're in a little bit of a crossroads here, and that they've got some questions to answer, but if they can come back and play well on the field, it won't really matter. That being said, Florida State's super, super talented, and I've actually heard a couple of pundits think that both Florida State and Clemson could make the playoffs out of the ACC, which is ridiculous in my opinion, but that's maybe a call for another or a topic for another call later. But Florida State's precarious at the quarterback position, suspending their transfer. So they don't have a lot of depth there. That being said, they've got probably one of the top three running backs in the country, really nice defensive talent, probably the best cornerback in the country or one of the top three guys there. So I think it's going to be close. I think Florida State edges out Ole Miss just by maybe a field goal late in the game.
Yeah, I definitely see this being a close game as well. Neither of these teams are terribly solid. That's not true. They're both very good teams. I don't think that they're incredibly well-rounded teams in so much as, like a team that has what it takes to get to that next level, win a conference and then make it to the playoffs. So, I think this is a fun early season game. I don't see it having too much long-term impact on the college landscape.
I was going to say, Chad Kelly is one of those guys that could easily be the best quarterback in the country or the worst. And that could change on a week-to-week basis. So he'll be interesting to watch.
Yeah, it's definitely, Ole Miss goes as he goes. And so you're right. Absolutely right. I did want to say, I just found this on Twitter. It's a really interesting kind of funny note from Barstool Sports. Jim McElwain, the Florida head coach, Melissa, never learned his punter's name when he was the coach at Colorado State. Never learned it. Know what he called him?
What?
Called him Punt Guy.
Punt Guy. Oh, I just became a Florida
punter,
fan.
Punt Guy. And with that, Jim McElwain leaps into the top five of my coaching power rankings. That really didn't exist before this point, but they do now just so that Jim McElwain can be in the top five because he called his punter Punt Guy.
Well, with that, blog guy, I don't know that we could end the show on a better note.
No, we definitely can't. She is Melissa. I am Jamie. You've been listening to the Frogs of War Live podcast. Have a good night. Boom.
Nailed it.